The president was silent for a moment. And, for some reason, you can't get control of this situation, which is why you're here. First, tell me why it's out of control. Second, tell me what you need.
It's not out of control.
Then why are you here?
Sir, I need a TRA. I need to surveil in the area where this disclosure event took place.
You have TRA-1.
Mike Wilkes is using it. He's on detail out there now, but he needs backup.
Okay, you've got another TR. I'll cut orders for you to have access to one. What else?
I need some people killed. Tout suite.
Just do what you gotta do.
You need to be aware that one of them is Mr. Crew.
Oh, fuck.
Exactly. Our friend from the beyond is not our friend.
What's he done?
He's giving the Greys support.
Next.
I need one other thing.
Hit me.
Charles smiled. I don't want to hit you. I want you to hit Wilton, Kentucky with an earthquake. Enough to disrupt the place and reduce the college that's there to rubble.
The president stared at him for some little time. Why? He asked at last.
We need a diversion so that we can clean up all the principals. We need it to look accidental. All the folks who were present during the disclosure event.
I see. He looked down at the top of his desk. This time his silence extended even longer. When he spoke, his voice was soft with what Charles knew must be pain. You know, it feels like the best day in your life when you walk for the first time into the White House as president. President of the United States. Wow. And wow again. Then you find out the secrets, and you spend the rest of your life in mourning.
Mr. President, this will be a very localized hit. It's not going to activate any fault lines, nothing like that. We'll see significant disruption, and a few deaths, obviously. It will be a cover for us to sterilize the area. We'll confiscate all original video and deal with the people who were first-hand witnesses. We have assets already at work who will get a local physics professor who saw the thing to debunk it. Our media people will see to it that his message gets spread far and wide. But the damage and the deaths will be the minimum necessary, let me assure you of that. I feel the same way you do about the American people, of course.
You're assuring me that this will not do any more than the minimum damage necessary?
Absolutely. It will be very precisely contained. We'll have a TR directing the pulses from the immediate vicinity of the target.
And the Greys are not going to react adversely? That is one limb I sure as hell don't want to go out on.
Sir, again, there is no way. They are not going to be able to connect the dots, as it were.
I'll redeploy the scalar weapon.
Thank you, sir. I'll call you when I need it fired.
God only knew what the Greys would do to the president after he unleashed a scalar pulse that devastated the whole center of the United States and threw all their plans awry. One thing was certain. Charles planned to stay far, far away from this particular moron after he pulled that particular trigger. I have a state dinner in an hour. I gotta go over to the rat hole and put on my monkey suit and spend the evening with the Prime Minister of Thailand, whose name I will never, ever learn to pronounce, who is here to whine at me about some damn thing or other. He stood up. The interview was at an end. Mike Wilkes lay in his motel room trying to do anything except worry about the next few days. He had a difficult, complex task, and if the Greys detected him, he was going to be something worse than dead meat. Over the years, they'd found bodies of people who had been attacked by the Greys, mostly airmen who'd gone too close in the early days, when Truman was still trying to shoot them out of the sky. They would have their lips cut off, their eyes and tongues gouged out, and their genitals removed. There would generally be seawater in their lungs, no matter where the bodies were found. The Greys would cut them up, drown them, then leave them as warnings. The Greys could very definitely be crossed, and this particular action was certain to qualify. He really did not feel so comfortable right now sitting in this dismal little hole of a room and, frankly, waiting to start getting cut to pieces by somebody he couldn't even see. He long held that the Greys couldn't read minds beyond a few feet, and that they had trouble even understanding what was going on in the human mind. But lying here on this bug-ridden bed, Watching Jay Leno wish he could suck any part of his guest, Drew Barrymore, he feared that the opposite might be true. His only chance was speed. If he could get this done by tomorrow night, he could be back in D.C. by noon on Wednesday, and maybe he would be okay. Maybe. At Alfred Air Force Base, the flight line was being used for foul-weather training runs, and the sound of engines being fired up and jets screaming off into the night could be heard clearly in the disused office block where Lauren Glass and Rob Langford had been together for hours. Since he had caught up with her last night, he had not let her out of his sight. And now that she'd understood that there were two opposing groups within the Air Force, she was glad that she had ended up with Rob. She had never liked Colonel Wilkes, and had not been surprised to discover the danger he posed to her. She sat across from Rob in the office watching the snow sift past the windows. She was exhausted, and she was hoping that he would soon let her rest. He remained formal and distant, though, and showed no sign of either becoming more at ease or of offering her a place to sleep. She wished it was not so. He was a lovely man, handsome in a way that made her want him, simply and frankly. His eyes were gray and intense, but also had a sort of wide-open look to them, as if he was as friendly as he was dedicated. They were the eyes of somebody who worked hard, but, she thought, also liked to have fun. He did not trust her. There was a secret he wanted to tell her, but he was wary. If he decided that she was the enemy, what then? She knew what then. She just didn't want to think about it. "Tell me again about your relationship with Adam," he asked. In all these hours she had not refused to answer a question, no matter how often he had repeated it. She knew this interrogation technique. She would let him use it. She would cooperate fully. "I've been with somebody who shared the life of my soul," she said. "I don't think he was a predator, like Mike said. Losing him has left a hole in my life, almost as bad as when my dad died."
"That's not what you said the last time."
"I'm being creative."
"What you said was, they aren't predators, but I think they're missing something they know we have, and they're trying to get it."
Rob could not take his eyes off Lauren Glass. It wasn't just her beauty. It was the trembling, delicate play of emotions in her eyes as she spoke about Adam. He could see that the love was genuine, entirely so. But there was also something furtive about Lauren, as if, on some level, she might be lying to herself, and might at least sense that. This long, repetitive interrogation was leading to a judgment. When he was finished with it, he would draw his conclusions, and her life would either continue or it would not. He wondered if she knew, decided to assume that she did. "So tell me, are the Greys a danger to us? How do you feel about that?"
"I guess I miss Adam more because I know he's somewhere. If he died in the fire, that would have been closure, you know?"
She fell silent.
"That didn't answer my question."
"It did, indirectly. If you want a precise answer, I have never been able to figure out exactly what the Greys are here for, so it's pretty hard for me to tell if they're a danger. I mean, they look like aliens. God knows they act like it. But I've seen the Bob autopsies. They're partly biological and partly manufactured, and they have no brain as we know it, just all those threads of glass in the head, but far, far fewer neurons than we have. So why do they think so well? We don't know. And since we can't say what they are, we also can't assign motive. Those are my thoughts, anyway."
He watched her. He didn't know exactly what he was waiting for, perhaps for some mistake, the nature of which would only reveal itself when she made it. Potentially, at least, this woman could play an important role. He had no doubt that the Greys had maneuvered her very neatly out of Wilkes's hands and into his, and he had understood that it was so that she could perform a function with the child. Teaching, he thought. She asked him, "Listen, do you know anything about them, like where they're from? I've always asked Adam about that, but you know, he doesn't tell you much." She wasn't afraid of him, and that was good.
"We don't know anything about where they're from. We do know that there are a lot of them out there, and they're on their way here."
"So the DNA thing is true?"
"You know about that."
She nodded. Mike told me that they've used up their DNA and they want ours.
That's part of it.
So this is the reconnaissance element of an invasion force and we should fear them.
I didn't say that. I think they may also be our only chance of avoiding extinction.
Her lovely mouth opened. The tip of her tongue, a soft pink pearl, ran along her lips and withdrew.
Are you?
No. She shook her head.
Wow. That's big.
The calculations are correct. There's going to be a tremendous environmental breakdown. In fact, it's been building for eons. We're at the climax.
She sat there, staring at him.
Lauren?
What about babies?
He shook his head.
Nobody makes it, except your friend Mike and his outfit. Have you ever heard of the Trust?
No.
The way they've got it set up, about 1 million people will survive, chosen by the Trust, Mike and his group.
But then the Greys will get them. They'll have gained nothing.
That's not how it works. We have reason to believe, to know, that the Greys will give up on us unless there are billions of us alive. Smaller numbers will be of no use to them. The reason that Adam left when he did is that something has come to crisis, and Adam is apparently involved. Man and the Greys are both in danger of extinction, and they're trying to save us all. Your boss and his friends are trying to prevent that so the Greys will go away and leave the Earth to their 1 million elite.
He watched her thinking, saw the pain in her eyes, the shock, saw a young woman's face reflect fear for children who had not yet been born.
What happens if the Greys get their way?
Lauren, a very long time ago there was a war on this Earth. A great civilization fell. When it did, we lost our knowledge of how physics really works. We set off down a road of ignorance that's led to where we are now, all 6 billion of us trapped on an overburdened and dying planet. Meantime, the Greys are so ancient that they've used up their DNA. Without each other, both species go extinct. They're looking for a sort of marriage. They get access to our youthful DNA. We get access to their brilliant minds. Everybody survives.
But how? What happens?
Lauren, it's my growing belief that you are one of the most critical human beings now alive on this planet, because you are a big part of the answer to that question. Suddenly she looked every inch the soldier. Her eyes flashed. Rob thought, as always, that the Greys had chosen well. She would be able to do this. He made his decision about her after all these hours in that split second. The Greys had given her to him so she could be the child's empath. It was the only explanation that made any sense. You'll be a sort of teacher, Lauren. An interpreter, if you will.
Of who? Of what?
I don't want to be mysterious, but it's best that we let this unfold in its own time.
That's hard.
So be it. Duty is duty.
I've one further question. Do you know how to hide? I mean, on a trained professional level.
Why in the world should I hide?
Colonel Wilkes had no right to do what he did. You said that yourself. He's up on charges.
He's also very powerful. More powerful by far than we are. He's dangerous, Lorne. I hope you understand that.
He's trying to kill me. Of course I understand it, but I have no idea how to hide.
You got this far, that's saying something. A hell of a lot, in fact.
If I'm a KIA, then I have no Air Force standing. If I'm already dead, he can kill me without fear of penalty.
We're going to hide you, Lauren.
I wish the Greys were here.
Keep trying to contact them. When they went outside, the snow of earlier had stopped. The base was very quiet, the flight line now shut down. She noticed that he moved very quickly, striding across the base to the carpool. He had a car of his own, but he requisitioned a staff vehicle instead.
This is part of staying hidden, he said. I'll exchange this for another staff vehicle after I drop you off.
He took her to a Days Inn, which appeared to be about the only motel in this small town. Thus it was that Lauren ended up in the room next door to Mike Wilkes,
an event that had not been orchestrated by the Greys, but was not entirely chance, either. Rather, it emerged out of the fates of both species, human and Grey, as they rode the dark rails of their destinies. Mike heard voices next door, a man and a woman. He took no notice. Rob wanted to stay with Lauren, he told himself, to protect her. But he had work to do, because if he didn't find Wilkes, not only was Lauren going to be in trouble, the rest of this thing was going to come apart. He could not imagine the consequences if the Greys were thwarted, dared not even think about what might happen. As he drove back to his office, Mike Wilkes and Lauren Glass both lay on their beds, unable to even think of sleeping, their heads separated by just 6 inches of drywall. Lauren's mind whirled with the astonishing secret she had learned. And, as she sank into exhaustion, also with the image of Colonel Rob Langford, who appeared to her as a sort of angel, powerful and good and strong enough to take her the way she loved to be taken, and give her the babies her whole heart and soul told her that the future needed. Mike would doze for a moment, then see Adam looming up, his insect eyes glaring. Then he would start awake and toss and turn and nuzzle his gun close to his side. Far overhead, in a sky that had cleared magnificently, strange stars hung over the town. The three thieves had been joined by Adam, and the first phase had been accomplished. They were counting the hours now, the minutes, the seconds, the nanoseconds until they acted again, and Adam entered Connor and became part of him. And either it worked, or it did not. It was an amazing time, truly, with 6 billion human lives and 6 billion Grey lives hanging in the balance, in the quiet of a little town, in a dark corner of a small state, in a strange and faraway place called Earth.
Part 7. Lost Land. There was a child went forth every day, and the first object he looked upon, that object he became, and that object became part of him for the day, or a certain part of the day, or for many years, or stretching cycles of years. Walt Whitman. There was a child went forth. 20. Connor and Polly woke up late and had to rush to get to school. When Polly saw Connor's mixture of amaranth flakes, wheat germ, and unsweetened live culture yogurt, he did not ask for an explanation, but gratefully ate the bacon and eggs that Dan, wearing only green boxer shorts and huge fluffy slippers, provided to him. He was fascinated to watch Connor eat what looked like upchuck. Connor had called in aliens, which was damn amazing, but now here he was gobbling down this fantastically geekish food. Nobody could eat like this and get away with it. Polly had an obligation to uphold the reputation of Bell Attached as a cool school. "So where's your lunch?" he asked Connor. They'd stop by his house to pick up his, which would be Cheetos, a ham sandwich, and a power bar. "My lunch?" He went over to a little plastic greenhouse that was sitting on the kitchen counter. "Ah, excellent. Sprouting alfalfa, I'm happy to say. Some organic hummus, which is really pretty delicious if you'd like to share, buddy." Aliens or not, Polly saw that the Connor Busters had to continue. "Sounds great, but I've got my dumb old ham sandwich waiting for me at home." Dan listened to the boys with only half an ear. Connor had somehow managed to bring this off, it appeared. He was more socially resourceful then than he seemed. All to the good. During his own wakeful and uneasy night, Dan had made a decision. Once he was tenured, he was going to do the unthinkable. He was going to circulate his resume, and he was going to concentrate exclusively on schools in large cities far from here. An untenured professor was an academic beggar, but a man operating from tenure was more significant, even if he came from the lower ranks of colleges. The reason he was going to do this was that he wanted to get his family as far from open spaces and dark abandoned nights as he could. Preferably, he would raise his remarkable boy in a Manhattan tower, someplace like that. Connor was vulnerable, and Dan's instinct was that moving to a more populated area would protect him. As for Caitlin, she was in the process of putting Marcy behind her. She dressed for her morning round of classes while listening to the males crashing around downstairs. She would not have believed Connor's skill in recapturing Polly. She'd been furious with him last night, but now she was proud of her son. She hurried downstairs to be in time to give her men goodbye kisses, accepted with dear brusqueness by her son, with hopeful eyes by her husband. She let him hug her. This family was her responsibility and her achievement. She was not going to let it go awry simply because he'd done something foolish and she felt humiliated. Men are fools, her mom had said. Expect the worst. As indeed her dad had been, disappearing on them the way he had, effectively orphaning her and widowing mom. So far, her mother's advice had never been wrong. At the Days Inn, Lauren Glass was awakened by a tapping on her door. She was shocked, then frightened. Then she remembered the code that Rob had given her and recognized the pattern of taps. As if a motel room door would keep out Mike Wilkes or whatever goons he might send. She still had no clothes but what she'd been wearing when Mike had attacked her, so she went into the bathroom and wrapped herself in a towel before cracking the door. What time is it?
6:50. We've got to get started.
What are we doing?
Trying to figure out where the kid is, if he's really here, or if this is some kind of feint designed to throw Wilkes off, in which case we can concentrate on the issue of you. But we need to solve the child question first.
His life before hers, that was clear enough. The Greys aren't protecting this child?
We're not in communication with the Greys anymore, as you know.
I do indeed. And I have to tell you, I just don't see them as really understanding how jeopardy functions in our society. They know how the brain works, but I don't think they understand reality the same way we do. We need to assume that they're going to be blindsided if this child is attacked. Mike Wilkes was returning to the motel from the early run he took every day when he saw from a distance of about a quarter of a mile two people get into a U.S. Air Force motor pool car in the parking lot and drive away. A man and a woman, but too far away to see their faces. He noted that they'd been parked directly in front of his room. He decided that some sort of Air Force investigative unit must have been activated, no doubt because of what had happened last night, when Lauren Glass had appeared at Wright-Patt after he'd listed her as KIA. He put in a cell phone call to Charles.
Hey there, sorry I'm so early. Yeah, it went fine, at least the trip was fine. Look, there are a couple of officers in mufti sniffing around. I haven't gotten a close look at them, but I have the feeling that they're an arrest team. I need that handled, Charles.
He hung up quickly and did what he now had to do with his cell phone, which was to take out the battery and throw the whole instrument in a ditch. You might as well paint yourself purple as carry one of these things. If you had a cell phone turned on or turned off, they could track you from 25,000 miles overhead with the Watchstar satellite. He had probably a dozen cover identities. He didn't even remember them all. Some of them were essentially perfect, provided to him by the Defense Intelligence Agency. They would stand up to the most rigorous scrutiny. Others, thrown together as needed over the years, were less reliable. But all except two of them were on file somewhere within the U.S. government. So, at the moment, he had only the two to choose from. He decided to stay with the salesman he'd used last night. He found a gas station, went in, and asked the attendant for directions to the nearest rental car agency. He had about 12 hours to perform a whole complex sequence of actions, then the night to do the really challenging work. The three thieves watched Connor leave home and be driven to school. So far there had been no threat against him. They wanted to be closer to Connor even than the collective demanded. He was their creation too, and his mind was like a garden of jewels. They wanted to partake of his rich feelings, but they dared not. He was too precious to disturb in any way. Because as a species they were so close to death, the Greys were particularly terrified of it. Their main body was alone in the immensity of space, no longer protected by a home planet and a parent star, their own having long since perished as victims to time. They traveled now in an engineered world on what many considered a hopeless quest, and their collective mind dreamed of oblivion, and worried about it, and clung. The thieves had spent much of the night hanging over the town, listening to the people they could hear through implants, trying to ascertain if any of them might seek to harm their treasure. Last night they had carried out the instructions of the collective, and prepared Connor to receive the extraordinary implant that was going to be given to him. The fragment of the collective the humans called Adam had been assigned to man some years ago, with the hope that Adam, through exposure to them, would evolve structures in his mind that would enable him to do something that no Gray had ever done before. Indeed, that was only an idea, a theory, perhaps a hope, and maybe a forlorn one. They wanted him to meld into the boy, in effect to implant his entire being into Connor and become part of him. Now Adam lay waiting in an empty barn, on the floor of a disused horse stall. Later, when darkness fell, he would complete his mission. Death was in this for him, but a very strange sort of death. It would not be the oblivion that was at the center of the long, complicated drama that obsessed the collective, but rather the surrender of self in a sort of living death. Once his thoughts and knowledge became part of Connor, he believed that he would disappear entirely. He listened to the dripping of the old barn and the rustle of beetles in the hay, and dreamed formless, uneasy dreams. The three thieves were fascinated and horrified by what Adam was being called upon to do. Like every Gray, in the privacy of the self, they regarded it with horror. Superficially, though, they were grateful both that he was trying and that they didn't have to. The Grays in the scout group had various human genes, this and that, whatever they'd been able to use, and were much healthier than the ones in the main body. The three thieves, for example, had human blood, vivid with life, not the dank, artificial goo that sustained most of those in the main body. They had taken this blood and adapted their bodies to it, and used it now as their own. It made them quicker, smarter, and also, they thought, more able to understand man. The three thieves watched Connor from above as he moved about in his school. They wanted to get closer, but could not go into a crowd and remain invisible. They could lock their movements to no more than two or three pairs of eyes. So they could not enter his school. They could only watch. This was why Grays worked at night, when people were alone. Connor had slept a restless, frightened night, and now sat in history class bored senseless because he had realized that his teacher did not understand the events in the Napoleonic Wars that he was teaching. The French loss of the Battle of Borodino in 1812 had led inevitably to the political structure of modern Europe, and discussing the way that had happened would have been interesting. Instead, he had to listen to stupefying trivia about General Kutuzov's bad feet and Napoleon's good lunch. His chest hurt. He remembered some kind of fire, but he had not been burned. He knew he had seen the Greys, but it all now seemed curiously unreal, like it had happened to somebody else, or not happened at all. This disturbed him. He knew that he had seen them. He remembered them, though in the unstable way that you remember a dream. He understood that this was because the experience had been so strange, but it still troubled him. He wanted these memories. He knew that the Greys were here for a reason, and they were obviously interested in him. But what was the reason, and why him? At the 10:15 break, he caught up with Polly before he had reached the protection of Kevin and Will. "Do you still remember?" he asked. Polly stopped opening the combination on his locker. He stared down at his feet. "Yeah," he said in a low voice. "Polly, I'm scared." "I wasn't when we got up, but I am now."
"Yeah, the same thing's happening to me. I don't want to go home. I don't want to be there at night."
Polly looked at him, his eyes hollow. "I was going to restart the busters," he said. "But I'm not. You're having too rough a time. But I don't want us to be together again, Connor. I don't want ever to see those things again, not ever."
"I can't handle it either."
"Yeah, you can. You're as smart as any alien. That's why they're after you, I think. Because you can handle it." Connor's throat closed and tears welled in his eyes.
"No, I can't," he said.
Far above, the three thieves felt his fear and drew closer together in their own disquiet. What was the matter with him? Was he in danger? Helplessly, they watched the purple fear flowing up out of the shimmering haze of feelings that hung over the school like a many-colored smoke. They could tell it belonged to Connor by listening to it. They could also talk to him, but dared not. Last night they had done something with him that the Greys had never before managed with human beings. which was to form words in his mind that he could hear and respond to. Words, not images. They dared not do that now, because it might panic him, and that must not happen. Connor went to his physics section at the college, hurrying along the snowy walk that linked Bell Attached to the campus, and wishing that he was safe inside some building, and not exposed to the watchful, dangerous sky. 21. The sun was high in a thin haze by the time Mike reached the Enterprise rental car agency that was tucked between the Walmart and something called Goober's Used Trucks. He considered buying a truck instead of renting a car, but he didn't have but about $600 in his wallet. Too bad. A purchased vehicle would be a hell of a lot more secure than a rental, which any expert could trace, no matter what sort of identity he used. "I'd like a car, please," he said. He pulled out the Harry Hill driver's license and credit card. "Missouri," the agent said, looking at the license. "Yes, sir. Here trying to sell the college on some new band instruments." "Well, good luck. Pardon my French, but they're tighter than a witch's tit over there. You want a Grand Am?" "A Grand Am is good." "Looks like we're going to get some serious weather tonight. If you want, I've got a Volvo. It's $360 a week. Front-wheel drive might be useful, though." This was certainly true. "Yeah," he said, looking at the sky. "It sure might." He took the Volvo. In his top pocket was the remote control that would summon the triangle, which was laying by in some concealed drawer somewhere in the hills. The trouble was, it connected through the Milstar communications satellite, and the second he used it, whoever was looking for him would know both where he was and where the triangle was. Once he had the car, he went through a drive-thru and got some food. It was too dangerous to stop and eat, lest some sort of horrible serendipity expose him to those two investigators. Professionalism in a situation like this was defined by attention to detail. He also knew from long experience that going without food was a mistake when you were dealing with complex and stressful issues. Air Force Chief of Staff Samuel Gold was ushered into the presidential executive office next to the Oval, which was open. No matter how often he passed near that room, he was always inspired by its history. No matter which president happened to be sitting at that desk, the power of the office was so intense that it was like a kind of scent around them all. Gold saw the presidency of the United States as the greatest governmental institution ever devised to expand human freedom and happiness, so he was especially concerned about this order he had come to discuss.
"Sir," he began, "I won't take up but 5 minutes of your time. I am requesting confirmation of an order received at 0900 today, directing..."
"I know the order," the president said. "You're to prepare to fire the scalar weapon."
"Yes, sir. I just..."
"Sir, what you may not know is that this weapon is not stable. It's still in development."
"The tests have worked pretty well."
"Yes, sir. But you're going to fire it into the New Madrid fault line."
"Oh?"
"Mr. President, this thing is going to devastate the entire central United States. You might see 500,000 deaths and trillions of dollars in damage. Sir, if I may ask, why do you need to do this?"